So in a way, the talk is about mindfulness, but maybe even more about what gets in the way of mindfulness, the obstacles to mindfulness. And that's the theme of the fifth precept. So there are five precepts in the most commonly used list, the so-called lay precepts, in all the different Buddhist countries, all the Buddhist schools. So the first one, can anyone remember what the first one is? Maybe the most important. Not to kill or not to harm other living beings. And the positive side of that is acting from loving kindness or acting from metta. And then the second one, anyone remember? Second one? The second one is, sorry? Yeah, that's right. Not to take what is not given. And generosity is the positive practice connected with that. Then the third one is to abstain from sexual misconduct and to cultivate contentment. And the fourth one is to abstain from untruthfulness and to cultivate the ability to communicate well and authentically. Yeah. So that's what we've had so far. And today is the last of the five precepts. And this is the one to do with mindfulness, as I say. And I'm going to read out what it actually says in the original Pali. I think I will do that because we chanted it. Before we meditated, we recited it. So we said, and this is the most complicated of them all. It's the longest in the Pali. But Pali is a very beautiful language, so it's always nice to have an opportunity to say it. So it says, Sura Merya Majja Pamadatana Verimani Sikapadang Samadhyami. Now the last bit, Verimani Sikapadang Samadhyami, that's in all the precepts. And it says, I take upon myself the footstep of training. It's interesting, isn't it, the phrasing. I take upon myself, or I undertake the footstep of training. So it's not a rule. It's not something imposed from outside. It's not something that somebody else is telling you to do. It's a decision you're making. I'm going to take this on as a training method. And all the precepts are to do with that training method. And I think it's very inspiring to see these ethical principles playing a bigger and bigger role in your life. These little reminders as to how to cultivate skillful mental states that lead to actions which are really helpful, that really make a positive difference. That's all they're about. They're not about somebody else's list of what you ought to do or what is moral or immoral. At least I don't think so. So what about the fifth one? I've said that they're all, I undertake the footstep of training to abstain from such and such in a negative form. When I say negative, I mean what you don't do. The positive form is what you do do. And what it is, if you do it absolutely literally, it's to abstain from beer, wine, and intoxicants which cause carelessness. In fact, Sura Merya, they're two different kinds of drink, and nobody's completely sure exactly what they were, because they had different. If you went into a pub in 5th century BC India and you ordered, you know, could I have a glass of pale ale, please? They wouldn't know what you were talking about. They had their own special drinks, you know. They probably had, you know, they were probably all real, proper organic drinks, no doubt. People think that they mean, roughly speaking, fermented and distilled and intoxicating drinks. So some alcohol is fermented, some is first fermented and then distilled, and then to make sure it covers everything, just whatever is intoxicating, whatever intoxicates you. And then did you catch the last bit where it said, which cause carelessness? Now, I'm going to ask you to ponder something, and I don't answer yet, but if you think of the four precepts I mentioned before, not harming living beings, not taking and not given, avoiding sexual misconduct, and avoiding untruthfulness in their negative forms. And then look at this one, abstaining from, you know, beer, wine, spirits, intoxicants, which cause carelessness. There's a bit of a difference, or at least there's maybe at least two differences I can think of in their feel, in the feel of the fifth precept to the other four. And I'm going to come back to that later, why that should be. If you maybe you won't agree with me, but I think there's a difference in the approach. Anyway, I'll leave that for now. And what's the positive form of the fifth precept? With mindfulness clear and radiant, I purify my body. So you can see, I'm sure you can obviously see the connection, can't you? What you're saying is you're going to look for those influences which cause intoxication. Intoxication in the sense of impairing your mindfulness. So you look for influences which impair your mindfulness, and you try to reduce those influences. And then, with mindfulness clear and radiant, I purify my mind. So there you're saying, I'm going to look for those influences that enhance my mindfulness and awareness, and I'm going to try and encourage those. So that's the idea of this precept. So it's quite important, I think, quite an important one, this whole area of mindfulness. I wanted to start off with, just in the very ordinary sense, talking about drinking alcohol. We've just been having a conversation about the Notting Hill Carnival, and one of the obvious things at the Notting Hill Carnival is there's a lot of drinking going on. Notting Hill Carnival is this huge procession of a million people that all emerge, sort of descend on this area with a lot of music, a lot of dancing, a lot of costumes and things, and a lot of drinking, and a lot of people falling about and fighting and all that kind of thing. So, is drinking okay? I'm going to have a chat. We're going to have to get together in small groups at the end so you can talk about some of these things, because we're too big a group to get into a general discussion about it. But it's worth just thinking about that. What do you think about it? Is drinking okay? And what about for you personally, rather than sort of moralizing about other people and these youngsters that go to the carnival? What about for you personally? What effect does alcohol have on you? And what is the if there is a problem with it, what is the problem? Is the problem to do with when you get completely blotto, plastered, or is there a problem even with small amounts? And that's an interesting one to think about, isn't it? Do they affect your mindfulness, small amounts? Do you find, in your experience, that alcohol is a cause of heedlessness? Because that's the literal meaning of that pamadatana, causing heedlessness or causing carelessness. And according to the Buddhist tradition, one of the main issues with drinking is that it causes you to break the other precepts. So it's more likely, I don't know if this is true in your experience, but it's more likely if you're drunk, you'll get into fights, you will take what is not yours, you will get into various sexual scrapes and cause problems there. Your speech itself will no longer be authentic and truthful, maybe, and so on. You just won't have that discipline. So that's an interesting one to think about. And the Buddha was quite strict about it, I think. At least I've got a quote from the Suttanapatta here. He says, "A layman who's chosen to practice this Dhamma," in other words, this particular guideline, "should not indulge in the drinking of intoxicants. He shouldn't drink them nor encourage others to do so, realizing that it leads to madness." So it leads to madness, this is what it says. Unmada. Mada is the same, it's a very, very similar word, although apparently it's unrelated. Mada means madness or intoxication. "Through intoxication, foolish people perform evil deeds, and they cause other heedless people to do likewise. So he should avoid intoxication, this occasion for demerit, which stupefies the mind and is just the pleasure of foolish people." So this is from the very early Buddhist scriptures, from the beginnings of Buddhism. But today, you know, maybe things are different today, but I did want just to mention, it's a bit boring but interesting, as well as boring, is the effect of alcohol in the whole of society. I think it's just worth looking at that, isn't it? And I looked at some statistics. Alcohol is, first of all, a factor in a very large proportion of all crimes that are committed. So you get this other thing, your alcohol may lead to the breach of other precepts. It causes, in the UK, can anyone guess how many people die of alcohol-related illnesses? Per year. How many in the UK?
9,000.
9,000?
Oh, many more than that.
33,000. 33,000 people die every year. In the UK. Which is many, many more times as many people as who die on the roads. And of course, many of those who die on the roads die because people were drinking when they drive. So I think I just mention this just because it is serious. It is a serious issue. It's a serious problem for some people, at least. Probably most of us say, well, it's not a problem for me, but it is a problem at least for some people. Most of those deaths, by the way, are from liver disease. That's the big one. Rather than alcohol poisoning, is only 5% of those. It's mainly from liver disease. There is a reason, I think. I don't want to preach, actually, because this is, you know, I mean, personally, I have never given up drinking, although I drink very, very rarely. The last time was last autumn, I think. But I never sort of decided to myself, I won't drink. You know, a glass of beer is very nice, isn't it? But what I have reflected on is that even if one doesn't have an addictive relationship with alcohol, then there are some benefits to not drinking in a social sense. Because there are a lot of people around who do have problems with it. And if they're the only one that's trying to give up, it's really difficult. If there are a few other people around who are just not drinking, it makes it much easier. It provides a much more supportive environment for those people that are trying to deal with an issue that they have. So I think that it's worth thinking about that. However, Buddhist ethics, as you know, is about personal decisions. And those personal decisions are about the effects of what you do on yourself and on other people. And we're just trying to notice. We're just trying to notice the effects. We're not just trying to slavishly follow something because it's written down in the five precepts. And so there, I think it needs a lot of, you know, just honesty and just looking at one's own life. Say, well, what's it like? What effect does it actually have on me? What effect does it have on other people? So it's entirely up to you how you make use of the precept, how you take it. In early Buddhism, as I say, and still in most of the southern Buddhist countries, it is interpreted to mean just stay away from alcohol. But if you go to Tibet, say, or Japan, you'll find that they're much more lax about it there, and they'll say, oh, well, occasionally you're going to get pissed, aren't you? I mean, in fact, after a Zen retreat, there's often a party, a big party, where everyone, after all the discipline of the retreat, they all get completely out of their heads. I don't know if that's a good thing or not, but it's quite interesting, isn't it? Actually, I've never tried sake, but it does have quite a strong effect, I think. And the precepts are about, as I said, you remember, they are footsteps of training. They're to do with moving on in a natural way from where you are now. So it's not really, I don't think, a question of deciding, do I drink or do I not drink? It's a question of shifting in a direction that means you're doing fewer things that cause heedlessness and you're doing more things that encourage mindfulness. Assuming you think that's a good thing. You know, you're doing fewer things that cause heedlessness and doing more things that encourage mindfulness. And I think probably if your practice is alive, then you're probably looking at all your addictions, all your intoxications, and in a minute I want to talk more about the broader range of them than just alcohol. And maybe you're saying, well, I'm not satisfied with them. Of course I've got certain habits, I've got certain obsessions, I've got certain compulsions, and I just want to just gradually, in a very patient, kind way, work on them. You're helping them to change in helpful ways. Yeah, so if we think of other intoxicants, because the precept says, as it were, distilled and fermented liquor, or whatever those words mean, and then the next word probably means intoxicants in general. And it certainly talks about whatever causes heedlessness. So we need to look at other things. And of course, those other things may still be substances, like other drugs, but they may not even be things. They may not even be things that you ingest. I don't know if you agree with me, but I think there are lots of other activities, parts of life that one can be, one can have an addictive relationship with, that can be intoxicants. And it would be really interesting for people maybe to talk about this a bit afterwards. You know, if you feel, if you wish to, it can be very private, of course, but what are my own personal favourite intoxicants? What are the ones that really are big for me? You know, maybe it is alcohol, but maybe it's watching Game of Thrones on the television. You know, maybe that's what it is. I can't miss one of those. Must actually catch it, you know, or something like that. So you could think about these different substances, different infatuations, different obsessions, different habits, and try and get a grip about what is actually going on. Why is it that sometimes we find something addictive? And I'm not saying I completely understand this at all. There's been a lot of research into it, of course, trying to get to the bottom of addiction and why it is that some people are more prone to addictive behaviours than others. Some people do seem to have a personality that is addictive. But nevertheless, I think all of us have got it. I hope this isn't unfair to say this, but I think probably all of us have got it to some extent. And I suppose the simple answer, the immediate answer, is that you have something is pleasurable. You watch an episode of Game of Thrones and you really enjoy it. And you're really fascinated to see what happens next. So you've had a pleasure and you wish to repeat it. Or sometimes it might be not a pleasure, it might be a palliative. In other words, it might be something that reduces your difficulty in life in some ways. So, for example, for some people, drinking is not necessarily pleasurable in itself, but it just makes you, it sort of makes you forget about all your problems. So sometimes it's pleasure, sometimes it's a palliative, something that eases your difficulties. But whatever it is, you want to do it again. You think, it worked that time, I'm going to do it again. If I have twice as much, it should work twice as well. If I do it twice as often, it should work twice as well. And that's the simple and quite reasonable, rather rational sort of equation, isn't it? Let's have some more of it. You know, this was good, this worked. However, it doesn't work. I think I can almost say that as a sweeping generalization, that the addictive pattern, where you hope to keep repeating a reward, doesn't actually work. It's because happiness doesn't work in that way. You can never just double, you know, the size of your Magnum ice cream and think you're going to get double the pleasure. Unfortunately, it's not, or have to, you know, think, I enjoyed that one, I'm going to have 33 more. It doesn't actually work, does it? But unfortunately, things happen that mean you get compelled, you get stuck in it. So you have your second Magnum ice cream and you don't really enjoy it. But then, you know, you think, I'm not going to have another one. But a couple of hours later on a hot day, you think, oh, yeah, I need an ice cream. So you go for another one and so on. Do you see what I mean? This seems to be what happens in addiction, isn't it? So the pleasure probably, there's a momentary relief of the sense of lack that comes in when you take the addictive substance. But that's all. And then you feel jittery. You feel needy. You feel something's wrong. So unfortunately, it doesn't really work. Happiness doesn't come from pursuing pleasure, strangely enough. You think it would. But happiness comes from being fully engaged with life and gradually breaking down the limitations on your awareness. Now, how can you tell whether you've got to the addicted level? This is fairly obvious. You try not doing it and you get withdrawal symptoms. You feel discomfort. You feel distressed when you stop using the intoxicant. And this is why, at least from a Buddhist point of view, abstention or restraint are good things, because they're highly educational. So if you find that, you know, every single weekend, it's probably not every day, but every single weekend you want your Magnum ice cream, and you say, well, let's try not having one this weekend, see what that's like. It's really interesting to notice what it's like not to have the thing you're addicted to. And maybe to take a little vow, you know, maybe for a month, I'll try without it. Not for life, just try it for a month. No sugar for a month or something like that, for example. So this is why these vows of restraint are actually very common in Buddhism. It's very, very interesting to do that. So whatever it is that you enjoy, just sometimes try doing without it for a while. Not in order to dull down your life, but to experience yourself, what it's like to be you without those habitual props, without the chocolate or the Game of Thrones. And the other thing I think that explains addiction is the sense sometimes of the discomfort and dissatisfaction of life that needs to be swamped by something. You want something very strongly stimulating. You want a very strong flavour or a very strong hit, a strong buzz, because there is something about life that is not satisfying, that is difficult. Or even worse than that, and this is really common, I think, it's because you don't believe in your own worth. At least from maybe sometimes you do, but there are times when, in a way, you don't really believe that just you as you are fantastic, are fine. And so as a result, you need something to distract you from your experience. Your experience is not adequate of yourself. And this is a view, in a way. It's not something that's intrinsic in the experience. It's something intrinsic in the way you interpret your experience. To say, you know, I'm no good, or I can't do it, and nobody loves me, and all that kind of thing. And this is really difficult to deal with, I think. And I've got a feeling, for most people, it's not possible to deal with that issue alone. It needs interaction with other people, I think. You need somehow, if I'm right in saying that this is a key in a lot of addictions, you need somehow to enhance your feeling of self-worth so that you start to feel more at ease with yourself, more okay about yourself, happier with yourself as you are, not as you wish you were, but as you actually are. And the involvement of other people, of course, is just knowing that people do care about you. They have a genuine esteem for you. They have a genuine love for you. So if you can, I mean, this is difficult to actually artificially provide, isn't it? But if you, at least you can associate with those people that you know do care about you and do esteem you, then I think there's a chance of overcoming that issue of self-worth, which is such a common issue for people, not just teenagers, but even people of our age, or our ages. And of course, the lesson for me with that is that although I can't demand from my friends that they give me loads of love and esteem and all that kind of thing, maybe I can do it for them, because they're in the same boat. So if I can learn to offer genuine encouragement and appreciation for the people that I know, if I can learn to overcome my tendency not to do that, to hold back from it, then it may actually help them with their issues of self-worth, which probably I'm not even aware of, you know, but there they probably are. Now, when it comes to intoxications, going back to traditional Buddhism, the Buddha highlighted three particular types of addiction that he thought were the deepest and most relevant. And these are not things that might immediately come to mind, but they came as a realization long before his enlightenment. According to the stories, at least, when he was quite a young man, probably just after his marriage, he had this experience when he rode out with his charioteer and he saw four sights. And the first three of these were very shocking to him. Can anyone remember what they were? If you know the Buddha's life, it's quite interesting. A shock. An old man, that's right. A sick man, or a sick man, and a dead body, that's right. So he saw those. And what he said, when he was relating this later in his life, what he said, the shock was, he said, when I saw the old man, I realized I was intoxicated with my youth. When I saw the sick man, I realized I was intoxicated with my health. And when I saw the corpse, I realized I was intoxicated with being alive. So these are quite deep forms of intoxication, but he felt they were things that he needed to overcome. And that, I'll just read out a quote on this. He says, "Drunk with the intoxication of youth, health, or life, an uninstructed run-of-the-mill person engages in bodily misconduct, verbal and mental misconduct. Subject to birth, subject to aging, subject to death, run-of-the-mill people are repelled by others who also suffer from being subject to birth, aging, and death." And he carries on. "It would not be fitting, if I were to be repelled by these people, if I were find these people repulsive because of their infatuations with life and health and youth, it would not be fitting for me. As I maintain this attitude, seeing through these three intoxications, knowing the Dharma, I overcame my intoxication with health, youth, and life as one who sees renunciation to be rest. And for me, as a result, energy arose and nirvana was clearly seen." So in other words, he saw the possibility of enlightenment through seeing through those three intoxications. Yes, he saw, so he says, "I overcame all intoxication with health, youth, and life, and I saw renunciation as rest." In other words, as relief from those intoxications. "From me, energy arose, and nirvana was clearly seen." I've got a handout, by the way, with that quote on it. I've got all the other quotes are on the handout, so don't worry if you forgot to bring your notebook. Okay. Just a little interlude here, which is, why is the fifth precept strange? Has anyone thought about, you may disagree with me here, but it seems to me there's something different, or at least two things actually that are different about the fifth precept compared with the other four. Did anyone come up with any ideas on that? So remember, the other four are, in the negative form, abstaining from harming living beings, from taking what is not given, from sexual misconduct and from untruthfulness. And then the fifth one is abstaining from fermented and distilled liquors and intoxicants which cause carelessness.
I think the obvious one is the first four have to do with interactions with other people.
Yeah. It's sort of, at least directly speaking, it affects just yourself, doesn't it? Mm. So that seems to be one of the differences, is that that precept is something in itself. For me to pick up a glass of beer and drink it is a very, very different thing from me going up to Bodhi Leda and pushing her over, or going up to Vlasmani and taking out whatever's in his pocket, or I won't go through what I might do with the other one, but you see what I mean. They're definitely, they're interacting with others and causing real problems. At face value, all one's doing is just drinking a glass of beer, you know. So that's one of the two things that I thought was quite different about it. The other thing was, in a way, it's so specific. The others are to do with general principles, in a way, while this one is quite specific. Avoid doing this particular thing. So I think it might be worth just discussing that. Why is that? Why was this there? And there's a very interesting thing in the history of the precepts, which is, it seems that originally it wasn't one of them. Originally there were just four. And when the Buddha talks about ethics, he often talks about what he calls natural morality, the morality that should arise in any healthy society and should be taught by any healthy religion. And he always lists four elements to it. That is, not causing harm, not stealing, being sexually ethical, and not lying. Those four are the ones that are there. And it seems that probably at a later stage, but still during the Buddha's life, he decided he needed to add a fifth precept to that list of four. Now, we don't really know why, but presumably, because this was the Buddha's action, he did it because there were problems. He did it because there were problems with drunkenness amongst his followers. And he could see that they were getting pissed and breaking the other precepts as a result. And he said, I better add a fifth precept, hadn't I? And that seems to be why it happened, for practical reasons. And another interesting effect of this is that there's another list of precepts. The most common list of precepts in the early Buddhist scriptures is a list of 10 precepts. They're called the 10 Kusala Dharmas, the 10 skillful things to do. And they're the precepts that are taken on by order members, the 10 precepts. And in this case, the Buddha added to the basic four. He extended the speech to have four speech precepts, because speech is so subtle. And he also added three mind precepts to do with guarding your mental states. So instead of the specific one of don't drink, he actually gave some quite definite guidance on how to avoid covetous states of mind, how to avoid hateful states of mind, and how to avoid ignorant states of mind. So the rather weird thing is that if you're a mitra here, if you become a mitra, you will be taking on the five precepts. But strictly speaking, if you become an order member, you'll be dropping the fifth precept and taking on a different set of 10 precepts. But just because historically speaking, that was, you know, there were these two paths that the precepts took. For some people, there was one extra one added, the fifth. For some people, there were six extra ones added to make the 10 precepts. It's a little bit technical, I know, but it's vaguely interesting. But some people in our order feel we should make the 10 precepts 11 precepts. And there have been campaigns at times to add the fifth precept to the 10. Because occasionally in the tradition, you do get a list of 11, which includes the avoiding intoxicants precept. So that has been a debate in the order, which is not resolved. Anyway, so we've said that it's specific and it's to do with affecting you. And I've said that in itself, picking up a glass of beer and drinking it is not obviously a sort of a bad, harmful thing to do in itself. And in fact, maybe one could go further, and this is another interesting thing you might want to talk about afterwards. Maybe there are occasions when it actually could be useful. Maybe drinking sometimes is a good thing. An obvious example is if you're really inhibited. it does affect your inhibitions. If you're just tongue-tied, you can't talk to people, a little drink maybe will help you. So that might be something you'd like to talk about. There are the occasions when actually alcohol is helpful. My own teacher, Sangrashta, who you see here on his birthday last week, when he was 88, he used to live in a little flat in Muswell Hill, and there were just two or three of them living there, just him and one or two other people. And they used to have people coming around to see him. And because he was, the big, famous, high-up Buddhist, Stavira, and all that kind of thing, they were all usually very, very nervous. And if they were extremely nervous, he would ask Kevin, one of the guys, could you go out and get a bottle of wine? And they go out and they just, over the meal, they'd have a bit of wine, just to sort of loosen things up a little bit. He doesn't do that nowadays, interestingly, but he did do it in those days, rightly or wrongly. Yes, how are we doing for time? So, in the early days of Buddhism, this is the way it was recited. And this is from the Uposatha observance, which is still looked after on full moon days and new moon days in some Buddhist countries, where the lay people will take on a list of eight precepts. And when they recite these eight precepts, this is the way they do the fifth one. I just thought I'd read it out to you, just so you can hear how it's put, which is quite interesting. All enlightened ones, for as long as life lasts, have given up the taking of liquors and intoxicants. They've given up taking that which intoxicates, causing carelessness, and they're far from intoxicants. So all of you also have given up the taking of liquors and intoxicants. You abstain from drink which causes carelessness. For all of this 24-hour period, all of this day and night, in this manner you will be known as having followed the enlightened ones, and the precepts will have been observed by you. So this would be, not trying to take it on for your life. Just take it on for one 24-hour period. And this is sometimes done with the precepts in Buddhism. You'll just take it on for a limited period, but as a really strict vow. But the other interesting thing about that is the fact that it says, why are you doing it? Because that's what enlightened people do. And sometimes this is quite a strong motivation in a way in Buddhism, is to say, well, what would the Buddha do in these circumstances? Or what would another enlightened, or at least, maybe not enlightened, but at least what would a particularly wise or compassionate person do? And if you're not quite sure what to do yourself, that can be a useful way of thinking it through. So mindfulness. I've been talking mainly about the causes of unmindfulness, but I do want to finish by saying something about mindfulness. Do you remember the positive side of this precept? With mindfulness clear and radiant, I purify my mind. So why did the Buddha feel it was necessary to add this fifth precept about intoxication? Well, presumably because of the were people getting pissed, but also because of the value that he placed on being conscious, on being aware, on being mindful. Jack Kornfield says, who's an American Buddhist teacher, says, awareness is really precious and it is hard to come by. So because it's precious and hard to come by, it's regarded in Buddhism as being very important to guard your awareness, which means looking at those things which will tend to reduce your awareness and looking at them as being problematic, as being things that you might want to really, if you can, reduce your dependence upon. So the positive version of the precept is about mindfulness, and the negative version is about whatever makes you unmindful or heedless. So what is mindfulness like? Well, the precept says mindfulness clear and radiant. That's interesting, isn't it? That clarity of mind, but even more than clarity, the fact that if you're very mindful, it's as if your experience is illuminated. Things are more vivid, are brighter. Other people are more interesting to you. So mindfulness is clear and it's also radiant. It's about being present while your life happens, not missing what's going on. It's about also not being forgetful. One of the forms of mindfulness, sati, literally means recollection. So it means not being forgetful. And I think these are two slightly different aspects of mindfulness. The one of, because you can be very, very present, but you can still forget to get off the tube at the right stop. Or you can be very, very good at remembering what to do, but yet your mind's all over the place and you're not present because you're constantly, no, I mustn't forget, I've got to get up at Holborn, then I'm going to go up the stand. Maybe I should move down the train a bit. It's all happening, you know, in your mind. So you're not very present, but at least you're not so forgetful. It's also about having a clarity of purpose where you know what you're doing and why you're doing it. And this is an aspect of mindfulness called samprajanya or samprajana. It's also about having an awareness of your mental states, of what state of mind you're in, and whether it's a good idea to act from that mental state or not. In other words, whether it's a skillful mental state or not. And this is the heedfulness kind of mindfulness that's particularly associated with this precept, which is called appamada. And the very last words of the Buddha, the last words he decided to say to his disciple just before he died were appamadena sampadesa, which means with heedfulness, put in effort, make an effort. And those two things were the things he really stressed. You need to make an effort, but you need to do it with awareness, with strong awareness, particularly looking out, looking at your states of mind, and also looking at the way your state of mind changes. It's not that I know, that's what state of mind I'm in. Good, I've got that sorted out. I don't have to think about that again till tomorrow, because the mind changes so quickly. So you watch the constant shifting and changing of your mind. And the Buddha's analogy, when he talks about mindfulness, particularly this heedfulness kind of mindfulness, is he says mindfulness is like a bouncer. The bouncer stands at the door of the club and carefully looks at everyone who wants to come in and has to make a decision. Yeah, you can go in. Or, sorry, no, go away. This is what mindfulness is. It's standing at the door and it's deciding. It's looking at influences, looking at your own states of mind, looking at your own mental events, but it's also looking at all the inputs, all the experiences that come in from outside and saying, this one I'm going to welcome. That's going to have a really good effect. You know, so let's say you were going through the carnival we were talking about. You know, you look at the beautiful costumes and then you say, I'm just going to take that down. I'm going to really enjoy that. And then maybe you look at some people that are really tense and all that kind of thing, and you might get nervous and involved. You say, I'm just going to stay away from that, you know. So this is the bouncer of the mind. Mindfulness is the bouncer of the mind. And in summary, this is what the Buddha says. In giving up intoxicants, the disciple of the noble ones gives freedom from danger. Gives freedom from danger to others, in other words. Gives freedom from animosity. Gives freedom from oppression to limitless numbers of beings. And so he gains a share in limitless freedom from danger, freedom from animosity, and freedom from oppression. So by being ethical, it said, you give freedom to others and you share in that freedom. This is a great gift. It's original, it's long-standing, it's traditional, it's ancient, it's unadulterated from the beginning. It's a gift that will never be open to suspicion, and it's unfaulted by knowledgeable people. And it leads to welfare and happiness. So that's what the Buddha says about the practicing of this precept. So my final suggestion is to try and just consider what it is in your life that makes you more conscious and what it is in your life that makes you less conscious. What it is that makes you face to face with life. What it is that wakes you up and what it is that has the opposite effect. And that's all this precept is about, is just being aware of that and then making the decision. What am I going to do about it?